in past years, we learn Megillas Rus with the Nachlas Yosef Pirush on it. Nachlas Yosef was written by Rabbi Yosef Zev Lipowitz. He was a Talmid Alta Sabotka. He was born about 1890 and was nifted in 1962. He was a person who had a way of giving over Torah to people broad public. He lived in Tel Aviv and was and said shiurim for a very broad public of people, from a very, very religious, traditional, and even people who were not yet religious, and was able to reach them all. He was an extraordinary person. His pirush is exemplary in the fact that it uses the Chazal to understand the psukim, but does so by showing you how the psukim themselves lend themselves, how the psukim themselves indicate what Chazal is saying, and he also ties together the themes and the underlying understanding. This year we're going to do a piece that deals with it's in the first perek of the Megillah, and it's pasuk Yudalid onwards. And we have here the departure or divergence of the paths of Arpa and Rus. Now, some background information so that it'll be very helpful as we learn it through. We can point to four stations in the lineage of these people. There is one station of Lot living with his two daughters, and that produces Ammon and Moab. That's our first stage in the journey. He spoke about it prior, and it's in his introduction, and it's something that we will come back to maybe some other years. We have then we have Eglon, the king of Moab. Eglon, the king of Moab, was actually antagonist of Klal Yisrael, but when Ehud the prophet came to him, he stood up and walked four amos to greet him, and then Ehud killed him, actually. But the respect that he showed the Navi manifested itself in Schar, as we'll see later. The next stage are Arpa and Rus. They were both descendants of Eglon, who'd married Naomi's sons. And finally, the final phase of it is going to be David. So, we're going to start with the pasuk where Naomi is convincing them to go back and not to bother with her. So what happened was Naomi's two sons and husband have died. She's going back. She'd heard that there's something in Eretz Yisrael, there's a Yeshua again, and she's going back home. Her daughter-in-laws want to go with her, and she tells them, go back to your homes. Hashem will reward you. You've been wonderful. Don't go with me. So it says they cried, and they told her, we want to go back with you to your nation. Vatoma Noma said, Shovna Benosnai, my daughters, go back. Loma Telachnimi, why are you going with me? Ha'odli banim b'me'ai v'olecham l'anashim? Do you think that I have any more children left that I could possibly give them to you? You're going to a life that's barren. Go back, my daughters. I've been too old. There's no hope that I could ever get married. And even if I were to get married tomorrow night and have children, are you going to sit around and wait for them? Are you going to sit around and wait for them all your life, not being able to get married? Don't, my daughters. I've suffered a lot. Hashem has exacted punishment on me, and you don't have to suffer with me. Vatisena kolon vatifkena, they raised their voices and cried, Od. Vatishak arpa lechamosa, arpa kissed her mother-in-law, v'ruach dafkebo, and ruach stayed with her. Vatoma, and she and Rus stuck with her, and she said she told her go back to again she told Ruth go back to your nation and so on, and Ruth said, I'm going back with you, your God is my God, and so on and so forth. That's that. Those are the psukim. It's page 45 in the Nachas Yosef. He says this pasuk Yudalit says, "Vatisena kolona vatifkena." They raised their voices and cried. B'milas vatisena chasa aleph. In the word "raise their voices to cry," there's an aleph missing in the way it's written in the Megillah. Mefarshin Chazal toshas kochan shemalchus bochos. They were drained, emotionally drained. Orpa viruska miyachad nelomos achad v'ranirotzim v'amarim shal Naomi. They're struck dumb after the forceful words of Naomi. Ve'neim mikor dima, and they're crying. Ach mitoch ha'dmos ha'alolu, in the same rush of tears. Shoyeshavus amar zeneim. We see two devoted daughter-in-laws crying greatly. Nifudachem shatachoyes, but they've gone off, and their paths diverge, not to come back again, really. So he says like this: Keitzad yitochen shemausin dvarim sheshamashtem yepinaomi hein tiganam askansvul kolkach. How is it possible, from the same words of Naomi, we get two different responses? Ein zois ki im shmi asos shakolachzim hoyse shayna. There's something about the way they listened, about the quality of listening, that was different. I mean, on the surface, it sounds like Orpah is listening and obeying her mother-in-law. Her mother tells her, it's stupid, it's crazy, don't hang on to me. So Orpah is doing exactly what she was told. And Ruth is sticking it out. Chazal say the opposite about them. Why is she called Orpah? She turned her back on her mother-in-law. The Rus, why is she called Rus? She saw eye to eye with the Chamosa. That's what Chazal dashed. Now, that's really strange. It's the exact opposite. Naomi says, go back, there's no point in it, and so on and so forth. Orpah's following her instructions to the letter, and Rus is defying it. So I could understand if Chazal would say that she did a better than the other one. It's better what she did. But how do you categorize it as listening to a mother-in-law? So he says, Ki Naomi toch kedei divrei atchiya shebefiha. Listen carefully. While Naomi is telling him to go away, Kairoslan pamayim b'noisei mekoyim kaloisei. She calls them my daughters. B'mila imohis zu sheyotze makir liba. With that motherly tone, Sfuna kriya nistara mitzida. There's a hidden call. A mother never drops her children. So, how could a mother be telling her? That very, very soft tone, undertone, that Naomi's words echoed. Rus heard it, but Orpah didn't. Orpah heard it with her outside ear, not with the inner ear. Either she doesn't have it, or she doesn't want to hear it. Some people just hear only the surface things. They don't have that feeling for an inner voice. But she even thinks Naomi is kind of castigating her and saying, I've suffered a lot of bitterness from you. So we have the same statement. Orpah grabs it at its face value, and the face value is that it's not she tells them, leave me, and Rus hears her saying, my daughters, and she understands that she has to tell them not to follow her because it's not right for her to demand it. But down deep, she could be their mother and she is their mother. But in this way of listening, in the mode of listening, you pick up the first distinction between the two. Until this point, they're both equal. They're like twins, Bobsy twins. The words of Naomi become a litmus test to begin to reveal the difference between these two daughter-in-laws. Become kama shayne midas rasala, and how different is the level of dedication, devotion to her. Im sof sof hafcha orfa oref lechamoisa simesh atchelet keshel arofa mekashos. If she could turn around at this point, then it means that it never was firm. Orfa was only connected with the outer layers of her nefesh. It was a pleasant, good, nice relationship, but it never touched anything deeper. And that's why her kiss was very different. With the kiss that Naomi kissed her daughter-in-laws, she didn't want them to leave yet. What she did was she kissed them goodbye in a way that allowed for them to leave and allowed for them to stay. It's like, you know, sometimes you tell somebody, I have to go and I'm sorry I can't stay. For the person who's eager that the person not stay, or doesn't have the sensitivity to realize that a person may not be able to capable of expressing something, he says, well, okay, you said you don't want to stay, you're not staying. That's that. Have a good day and fine. The other person who, A, is interested in having this person stay and has a sensitivity, realizes he needs to be asked, it needs to be followed up, because there's a surface interaction that says, I cannot impose on you, it's not right of me to impose you, and a deeper level that says, I would like to be there. And then he uses, and the very fact that he uses a beautiful metaphor to describe the difference between what the kiss did for Rus and what the kiss did for Arpa. He says, "Kitala yored al perach beisiv luvay," like dew that falls on a flower as it's blossoming. Shemagbez anusa virecho, it increases. It adds to its life force, to its blossoming, to its development. So too did this kiss affect Rus. On the other hand, if you have a flower that's been cut off, and you put dew on it, the wetness hastens its disintegration. When something is not attached, and it becomes wet, then it rots much more quickly. So he's using it as a metaphor, just like when you put dew on produce, it depends very much if it's still a plant that's attached, or a vegetable that's been picked. So too, Rus and Arpa, the kiss of Naomi to Rus and Arpa, for one of them, it sealed the finality of the relationship, and for one of them, it deepened and strengthened the relationship. Now he says another interesting observation. Sometimes we think that when a person displays a great burst of emotion, it shows a positive attachment and it's great. The truth be said, sometimes when you display an extremely strong emotion, it's a way of getting rid of the emotion, and that allows you to continue onwards. It's like a steam valve, letting out the steam, and then you can just unemotionally go ahead and do something. So he says, the kiss that Arpa kissed her mother-in-law, her entire love and connection to her, she expressed through it. And with that expression, it was over. Chazal tell us, and Chazal in general, with the following statement, indicated that an overly display of emotions is not positive, only when the circumstance warrants it. Chazal say there are three types of kissing. There's a kiss when somebody has reached greatness, like Shmuel when he anointed Saul and he kissed him, you know, because as a sign of that he's become a bigger person, a greater person. Neshika shel prokim, a kiss when you greet somebody after a long time, was neshika shel Aaron or Moshe. And finally, neshika shel prishus, a kiss of departing, like it says, Vatishak Orpa l'chamoisa Orpa kissed her mother-in-law. Kloima. What Chazal mean to say is the same kiss can be the next step forward, and the same kiss can be the end of something. Kloma. Yesh neshika mechazek sakesh v'nishay anashim. There's a kiss that strengthens a bond in two people. Kei neshika smayshe v'aren. V'yesh neshika menatek sakesh v'nishay kaim v'nefsh nefesh. And there are some kisses that break that bond. Dugmu v'hekes v'kach hashik sh'orpa. Shemitoichi yefeches oirev l'chamoyse gong darka akademis. That kiss, again, because it was an explosion of emotion, it allowed her to finish with that. Orpah goes back to the Ma'avi roots that included a tremendous hatred for Klal Yisrael, and the and those roots would later show themselves as being as expressing themselves in her child Golias, who would fight against Klal Yisrael. Now he says, "Ach Orpah luchat chila gam yachin Naomi," but it wasn't all that way. She followed Naomi in the beginning. Ula espre dasmen harida demos, and as they left, she cried. Now this is an important point to understand Chazal's perspective on Torah and the world. The human, a human being has to deal with situations and make decisions for positive, negative. We judge people, circumstances, we evaluate, and we reach a conclusion. We must go by majority. That's the only way. So if a person is wicked and the court finds him wicked, the good he's done and the positive doesn't play a role in the sentence. We don't have the ability, it's impossible to take apart everything and every person. Every person is so complex, and we don't have tools for being able to separate the good out of the bad and so on. And we go by whatever is dominant. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a Dayan Emes. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is someone whose judgments are true because he judges each and every point. There is no good point that a person brought out, even if it's within a sea of bad, that goes unrewarded. Chazal say, when HaKadosh Baruch, Chazal say, the Orpah let down four tears before which she left. Yodu, Chazal knew she'ein adma zichozach li'ibud. Tears, real tears, don't go to naught. Ve'motzik v'seh makamachtach, they find it someplace else. Es arba eile yuldu la'arafa begas. She had four children who were giborim. Omer Rava, b'schus arba demos shehorido orpal chamoisa, zocher tzar giborim. So Rava says, because of the four tears that she let down in the parting, it means those four tears represent a certain attachment that she had to something good, important, big, that stayed with her. Mitzuyo Arna says to Chazal. Chazal gives us another enlightening demonstration. Amar Reb Yitzchak, Arba Milin Holcha Orfim Chamoisa. She walked 4 milin. She accompanied her for 4 milim before turning back. Those were points that were good in her, points of attachment, and for that she had 4 giborim. Orpah is a gamhi gevur. She showed a certain level of strength of character. She wanted to go. She in the beginning went. So, and Naomi blessed them both equally. She cried for leaving. It means that she had in her different spiritual elements, the good and the bad, they were struggling. And nothing goes to waste. So for the tears that she shed of good, it didn't go to waste. I want to digress a minute and speak about something parallel to it, but I think it's very important for us to know this. Just like everything good doesn't get wasted, there are things that are bad, even if it comes in a sea of good, that exact their price. Chazal tell us that when Yaakov took the blessings away from Esav, Vayizak Ze'oka Gedola Mara, he cried out tremendously. It says because of that, we went through the suffering of Haman, where it says by Mordechai, Vayizak Ze'oka Gedola Mara, he cried out. The Chazal are telling us now, in both cases, in the case of Haman, in the case of Yaakov and Esav, there was appropriate, what he did was appropriate. He was supposed to take the B'chaira, it's something which was, for whatever reason, his, and he should take it. But there was something that a pain, an unnecessary pain, that was caused to Esav. And because Esav suffered this pain, so I don't know if it was something that he had done a drop more than he should have, or it's just something which was inadvertent. However, it says that was the Zaka Gedola that came about later also. It says, Vayitzak Tzaka Gedola Mara Ad Ma'od. And this Tzaka Gedola Mara took its price till later. I want to say it in context of something. It's the first time in thousands of years, literally, that we were Zoha to be able to defend ourselves, to be independent at something that carries with itself tremendous responsibilities, in many ways, of course. But one of the areas we need to remember is what's needed to defend ourselves, we must. And there's nothing that that we should stop short that's needed to defend ourselves. But nothing allows us to do one drop more than we're supposed to do. In other words, to inflict on others even things that are to inflict any pain or suffering that is not required is something that will take a toll, chas v'shalom. So the Vayitzak Tzaka Gedola Mara of Esav and the Vayitzak Tzaka Gedola Mara of Mordechai, it took his price. It has to. Now let's get back to where we're holding here. So he says, "V'ochin shor shechad la'opav v'lerus." Shteim los eglon melachmov. Both of them come from Eglon, and they have something of b'mechabed var Hashem. Further back, they come from Noslot, and they both have this midah of sacrificing themselves for building the world. We've seen this in the past times about the fact they're willing to do something so low and so despicable as living with their father to save the world. He says both of these neshamas come from the same root, but they're not equal. The quality of one was absolute and nothing could stop her, and the quality of the other one had a certain limit. It was willing to go up to a certain point. When that inattention of ARPA reached its boundaries, it stopped. Now he says something over here that is extremely, extremely significant, and even in picture in our chinuch. It says, as soon as she realized, she still had some hope of maybe building a life as a Jewess. But after Naomi's words, she had no illusions, and she immediately began to arouse in her, awaken her, something that was hidden, that pushed the other side. And Chazal tell us that on the day that she left the Naomi, she lived the most loose life, the most licentious life. It says the day she left her, she did everything bad. What does that mean? So let's understand it, and I think it's important to understand it in terms of chinuch. We find this phenomenon sometimes. You find a child is doing very, very well, some glitch happens, and then he turns around so quickly, and you wonder why you went from 100 to minus 100. Why don't you go from 100 to 90 or 85? And the answer is like this. People live with certain models of achievement and attainment. And a person is living a life built on achieving a certain goal. So a person, for instance, a boy has an image of himself becoming a great gadol, and it's buttressed by the hundreds that he's getting on the test and so on and so forth. He also has in himself another self, would like to see himself a big basketball player, or the chevreman of the class, the naughty guy, the outcast. There are different images of greatness a person has, and they wrestle within a person. And when a person is matzliach with one mahalach, it goes. But if he gets upset, he does bad on a test, or a teacher will tell him something, you know, you really aren't what you think you are, something. In short order, he goes, turns around to look for something else completely, and a different image. Arfa had a desire to be a Jewess and so on. She also had a Moavit in her. She wanted to be a socialite. She wanted to be a woman of the world. She wanted to be popular in different ways. And once the heroic woman of mitzvahs it dissipated, so now she's looking for some other paradigm. And that's what happens. So the fact that somebody is holding very far positively has no bearing on what will happen, Chas v'Shalom, if the situation is not so good. Now, he asks, let me ask ourselves, he says, what should they have done? Brum, Legufa Shal Dovich Mokum Nishal. He says, let's ask ourselves, what should they have done? Should they have kept going with Naomi? And she made it very clear to them that she is not, there's no rational, reasonable way in which they will ever have built themselves. So what should they have done? I mean, was it right for Ruth to keep going? So he says, Orpah said, followed logic. She realized there's no point, and she went back. He said Rus was the path of individuals. We can't ask this of everyone. In other words, the logic, human logic, or logic in its big sense, dictated to go back. That would be right for most people. Rus lived by something else. I want to bring in a Gemara that has a similar story, and it's something which is very reminiscent of this point. Gemara says that Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan were both learning in yeshiva, and they were both very, very good students, and they were both very poor, And they decided they've got to do something about it, and they went out to they decided to go and to find some means of sustenance. As they were traveling, Rabbi Yochanan heard a voice come out and say that whoever turns back and goes back to yeshiva will become the next Rosh Yeshiva. Ilfa did not hear the voice. So Rabbi Yochanan says, being that I heard the voice, probably it's meant for me. And he did that. And Ilfa continued in business, he prospered, and he also remained a Talmud Chacham, and the Gemara goes on with some other stories about it. But I always wondered, so was it predestined? What was the right thing to do? What does it mean Ilfa didn't hear it? Hashem didn't talk to him? Ilfa turned a deaf ear? What exactly is right and wrong? So I would like to compare it to a Rambam. The Rambam, two Rambams that are famous and seem to contradict each other greatly. The Rambam says that a person should not take money for studying Torah. A person should rather earn a livelihood and spend a few necessary hours for a livelihood and then and study Torah the rest of the time. That's in Hilchis Talmud Torah. In Shmitas V'Yovelis, he famously states that Shevet Levi was designated as the Shevet that would not engage in worldly commerce or trade or anything like that. They would be sit and study and spend their lives in Avodas Hashem. And instead, they would Hashem would provide for them. He did it through Trumas and Maisris and so on. And also, and he says, so, and then the Rambam famously says, it's not only members of Shevet Levi, but anyone whose spirit moves him to dedicate his life to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he need not worry about worldly sustenance. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will find some way to support him, and Hashem will be his nachlosa like Shevet Levi. The Rambam sort of contradicts each other, and what's clear from the two Rambams is that there are people, the vast majority of people need to live within the framework of logic, of what makes sense and what works. And for a person like that, the right thing is the Rambam in Hilchos Talmud Torah to have a foot in both worlds. However, there are people whose spirit rises above that. And for those people, there's a world above that. And that's what it says over here. Erf and Rus, both of them have a heart that carries in itself those feelings. But Rus, he says, ha'emeshalei goyin ha'nushi nitzeyachas misurus ha'shal Erfa. The truth of human logic, in other words, means the framework of this world as it is and as we perceive it to be, that trumped Arfa's ideals. Al benafsho shel Rus noicheles nitzachon emes acheres. Rus had a whole different attitude. Emes nevu is the truth of prophecy. Hamidaleges alei goyin ha'mutzak. It skips over logic, uposas as psiosa gdolos harchek mevalei, and it overtakes it and goes far beyond it. Bederech shuvavila tikkun shalom. Hakorach shechzik as rus etzal nomi hu korach advekas rus dafka bo. The power that kept rus going was this power of dveikus that transcended it. If we could interpret it in a different language, in language for us, we'd say in Rus, Rus's attitude was, I understand that there's no real, that there's nothing for me to come, there's nothing for me to come to, but there's nothing for me to return to. This is the only life that's worth living. So either some miracle will happen, I'll have it, or there's just absolutely no point to it. That's the approach that she took. So let's sort of just recap this chapter over here. This is a critical point in the Megillah where there's a certain sifting out and a certain self-selection process between the almost and the great. Both of these neshamas had, Rus and Arpa were neshamas that had good in them, and they would express it. Kadosh Baruch Hu allows everything to express it. But they, at the gate of logic, at the filter of logic, one was stopped and one continued. When Arpa realized that there was really no way she could possibly continue and hope by any stretch of imagination to be successful in any way, to get married, to be part of Jewish people and so on, she said, okay, so it's clear I have to go back. And when she went back, she didn't become like a super frum mauve, she became a super mauve, because a person's drive is to be great, to be successful, and he chooses, he would prefer to be successful at the positive, but if need to be, whatever it takes. Rus had in her the drive for Emes no matter what. And that's why she heard from Naomi that in the voice of logic that she was speaking, she was telling them, go back. But the inner voice was saying, my daughters, there is something there. It's something that can't be translated into the words of logic. I can't offer you rational hope, but there's an emes that transcends all of those rational hopes, and that's the emes of Torah, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of Klal Yisrael. Rus is the person who made that leap. She said, I don't have a choice because there's nothing. I realize that the emes lies there and not here, and a life over here is a life not lived. That's where Rus comes from. Okay.